hardball hitting with a baseball bat. Kick up your heels, kid, and leave them all flat. What does it mean to be American?
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
2024 gave us an election like no other. It was contentious and hard-fought. Our show, Democracy Optimist, examined numerous aspects of the election system, from redistricting to misinformation to the actual process of casting your ballot. I remain a democracy optimist after the 2024 election because the process was fair, transparent, and resulted in the people choosing the leaders they wanted. Now it's 2025, an off year for elections in the U.S. But the work of election administration and preparation never stops. Indeed, it is perhaps even more important for us all to pay attention to the election system when the glare of scrutiny is off, as the election policies adopted in 2025 will impact the 2026 midterm elections and the next presidential election. There's never an off year for voting rights. That's true both in the United States and abroad. 2024 saw elections in nearly 80 countries worldwide, with around 1 billion people casting ballots. 2025 will also feature many important elections that will impact democracy, including in Canada, Germany, and beyond. Here to offer an international perspective on elections and democracy is Dr. Fernanda Barril, the Deputy Director of the Center for Applied Research and Learning at the International Foundation for Electoral Systems. She's an expert on sustaining democracy. Fernanda, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you for having me.
So first, can you tell us a little bit about your organization, the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, or IFES, its acronym? What is it and how does it help to sustain democracy throughout the world?
Of course, yes. Yeah. So IFES is a nonprofit and nonpartisan organization, and we work to strengthen electoral processes, governance, and democracy more broadly around the world. And we did this both through research and technical assistance directly. We currently have offices in 39 countries, but we've worked in more than 145 countries in almost 40 years of history now. And last year alone, we supported 28 national elections. So we work with election commissions, other public institutions, civil society, and our programs vary a lot depending on needs of partners and emerging threats. So our scope really changes, evolves, and expands all the time.
That's very fascinating because I think sometimes we have such a U.S.-centric thought process when it comes to elections and democracy, and yet you have elections and democracy all over the world as your organization is helping to facilitate the way we think about that. So tell us, why should we care here in the U.S. about how other countries approach democracy? You know, we're so different. We've got the Electoral College to select the president. We're generally thought of as the world's leader. So shouldn't they be looking at us as opposed to us so much looking at what other countries are doing?
Yeah, I think there are many reasons for the U.S. to care, and I can share at least two perspectives. One is why Americans should care about other countries becoming or remaining democratic, right? And it's not just about morals and maintaining the commitment to human rights and democratic values, but also democracies are less likely to go to war against each other. They are more reliable partners. They are more effective at dealing with catastrophes, for example. They can directly affect national security. But I think to answer your question more directly, why we should care about democratic processes themselves, right, in other countries, why Americans should care about how they conduct elections or prevent or address irregularities or deal with election complaints, for example. I think it's obvious by now that the threats to democracy are global. Right? They're happening everywhere and also originating in the most different places. So we can apply lessons learned from other countries to both prevent similar problems here and to inform solutions. So, for example, with the recent case of voter data breach in the UK, which the British government attributed to China, what kind of vulnerabilities did the malign foreign actors leverage, right? Do we have these vulnerabilities ourselves here? How can we patch them and protect the systems? So I think of comparative knowledge and lessons learned as very valuable shortcuts, because we get the benefit of hindsight without necessarily having to experience the problem.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And of course, while we're learning from other countries are also learning or at least observing us. In November last year, your organization, IFES, brought hundreds of election officials from all over the world to observe the U.S. election. I was there the day before. I spoke on a panel where they had basically a whole day's worth of education about the U.S. election system. And then these election officials from other countries actually visited polling places in Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. to watch the election. What did they learn? What do you think the big takeaway was for others who observe our elections, from others from other countries who observe our elections?
Well, first of all, thank you again for participating in our panel, Josh. It was very interesting. And the event itself is very unique, right? We bring so many election commissioners, authorities from everywhere to learn about the process and to share their own experiences as well. I think one issue that many visitors were shocked about was to see how different the processes were just a few miles away, right? So they went to different polling stations, as you mentioned. They saw different ballots, also different machines from different vendors, different security provisions, even for the polling station. And in most countries where IFES works, the election process is much more centralized and standardized. We usually have national election management bodies with some regional or local branches, but very different from the U.S. The other thing that they were very surprised about was that more than half of Americans had already cast their ballots right before the official election day. And so, yeah, there were certainly lessons learned about coordination, logistics, and this expanded enfranchisement, especially through the remote voting methods that they took back home.
Yeah, that's interesting that a lot of other countries, most other countries don't have the same kind of early voting opportunities and culture that has now sprung up about voting. And then the point on decentralization is interesting as well. You know, some people say that the fact of our election system in the U.S. being so decentralized is a good thing because places can try different strategies, try different methods of voting and see what works best. If you had, you know, one rule nationwide, maybe it would be a bad rule. On the other hand, it is a little strange compared to other countries and not having a national election policy in terms of how the process works. So do you have a sense of what other people, you know, they said they were, you said they were surprised about how decentralized it was. Did they think it was a bad thing? I know that's generalizing a large group of people, but did you have any sense of whether they thought this was a good system or a bad system?
Unfortunately, I can tell that the general sense was that was more of was more negative because they are election authorities, right? Mainly most of those visitors. So they already face those challenges in communicating internally within the organizations when it's a much smaller, more centralized institution. So just the thought of having to coordinate across so many counties all around such a big country, it was really scary for them. So they were just shocked that it works in the first place.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So let's talk about other countries now and what's going to happen in 2025. So around 70 countries, give or take, we're still trying to figure out if, you know, certain countries will actually have elections, but around 70 will have national elections in 2025. Some of these elections will occur amid a lot of instability and turmoil in those places. So where are the key elections that you and your organization are watching in particular with respect to sustaining democracy?
Yeah, you're very right. We talked about 2024 as being the year of elections, but this year is not going to fall too far behind, right? And at least 15 of those 70 countries are experiencing concerning levels of instability. Just to start with Latin America, for example, right? We have elections in Bolivia that's facing renewed political polarization, and the ruling party itself is very fragmented right now. Ecuador and Honduras also having elections this year. They have the problem of criminal groups not only undermining voter security, but also their very choice at the polls since they are infiltrating politics. Venezuela is also holding elections for the National Assembly this time. But we just watched the inauguration of Maduro, January 10th, despite his loss at the 2024 polls. So this confirms that the vote's not being respected there. As you mentioned, we have some elections that we're not sure yet if they're going to happen or not. In Mali, Burkina Faso, they're due, but the military juntas have postponed them. And of course, we're also keeping in mind other key post-conflict elections, not necessarily this year, but in Ukraine, for example, once the fight against Russian invaders is over, or in post-Assad Syria, when conditions allow. And what we'll be watching for is the extent to which these processes meet democratic standards, right? We hope to see proactive efforts to stabilize security, to rebuild infrastructure where needed, especially after conflict, to improve electoral legal frameworks, to enable fair and competitive processes, a free media environment, and citizen enfranchisement. So in other words, the opportunity for people to participate in a safe, well-informed, and meaningful way.
So a lot of what you just mentioned has to do with democratic norms, right? And I think one thing I've learned studying democracy as a law professor is how much our system relies on people adhering to democratic norms. How are you seeing that play out in other countries?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to start this conversation by saying that people around the world do still prefer democracy over all other forms of government. We have the data from the Pew Research Institute, from the World Value Survey corroborating this fact. But people are also increasingly dissatisfied with the way the democracy is working for them in their countries. So some political actors are leveraging this dissatisfaction with the status quo, running populist campaigns and getting elected. Once they get elected, they can erode democratic norms and mechanisms from within. So where this is happening, right? In El Salvador, we saw in 2019, the election was largely seen as credible. And Nayib Bukele won there. But then his re-election in 2024 was very controversial because originally the country did not even allow for re-elections constitutionally. But he made changes to the judiciary during his first tenure that led to a reinterpretation of the document. We saw this also, you know, in Hungary with the 2010 elections being credible and then the process eroding in the later cycles. Venezuela, even if we go a bit farther, 1998, when Hugo Chavez was elected, the process was seen as one of the most modernized and the best ones in the world. And it has been eroding since then. So just to say that the breakdown of democratic norms is not necessarily happening because people reject these norms. And it also doesn't happen only during elections. So we can have very legitimate elections and see the breakdown unfold afterward. So we have to work to identify the signs of erosion early on and respond quickly.
Of course, one of the worst aspects of a breakdown of democratic norms is when it devolves into violence. And, you know, the U.S. is not immune from that, as we saw on January 6th, 2021. What are the keys to avoiding election-related violence in countries around the world?
Yeah, and I last year actually talked to a lot of election commissioners in OAS, the Organization of American States, event about this, because it's a hot topic. Everybody's interested because it's on the rise globally. Right. And across the countries where we work, we see a variety of perpetrators of violence, incentives, tactics. So the solutions might differ. We have, for example, we see some research showing that narrow margins of victory tend to lead to more violence, or executive elections tend to be more violent than legislative elections. Right. So there is nothing really that we can do about that. But there are some things that are under the control or influence of election authorities and the government. So one obvious factor is the quality of elections, right? Poorly organized elections tend to lead to more protests and violence, especially when there are unexpected delays in the announcement of results, for example, or instances of problems and mistakes that during polls that gain traction online. So honestly, what I learned from this year is working on elections was that election officials are very rarely given the benefit of doubt. Malpractice is more often than not interpreted as deliberate fraud. So if you really want to avoid election violence, make sure your election is very well administered. And you also, of course, have to make sure that there is a fair system to address election complaints, right? Giving people a peaceful venue for seeking remedies and contesting results if they think it's needed.
Interesting. And of course, there's also the problem of misinformation, right? That goes part and parcel with this increasing the legitimacy and people's trust in the election system. How do we fight election misinformation? And, you know, there's even a question, was it in the country of Georgia that there was so much misinformation that there was actually called the election into question, if I'm remembering that correctly? So what do we do about misinformation that really infects the election system?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and especially after the annulment. I think you might be mentioning the Romanian presidential
election.
Oh, yes,
Romanian, that's right.
Yeah. The authorities there said it was disinformation, also among other irregularities, right? The best analogy I could think of was lead in the water. If I may ask you, Josh, how much lead do you want in your water?
Yeah, of course, none, right? everyone
right?
would say.
The yes, there is no safe amount of lead, right? But the EPA, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, has, they have set a zero-level goal, but also an action level. And above this, above the 15 parts per billion, there are more strict measures that must be taken, even the total replacement of service lines. And it doesn't mean that below that nothing should be done. There are some measures to remove lead from the water. But I don't know if you see where I'm going with this, right? Most elections will have their version of lead in the water. It could be disinformation, vote buy-in, voter intimidation, other violations. And we should keep aiming for zero levels and taking measures to reduce them whenever they happen. But we also have to establish clear thresholds for when more dramatic measures are needed, including the annulment, right, of the election itself. Because setting these expectations early and clearly to all stakeholders will hopefully reduce the likelihood of people perceiving decisions as politically biased.
And Romania, an election that was annulled, kind of reached that level?
Well, yeah, so that's it's still we still don't have a final answer, right? So the candidate Georgescu, he actually appealed before the European Union Court of Human Rights. It's something that it's a big challenge for all countries and the European Union itself more broadly, because the text is very basic that what they have about the authorities' right or duty to secure fair elections. Right. So we don't know exactly if the threshold will be acceptable for the European Union court, but it's interesting. The Romanian court itself has already scheduled to meet the elections for May, but we still have to see what the rules are.
Now, are you optimistic about democracy? I mean, you know, I call this show Democracy Optimist, and some people criticize me, but I think optimism is not, I think everything is great. It's that I've got hope for how things can be. For someone who studies elections all around the world, are you a democracy optimist?
I think we have to be optimistic. And if not, that things are getting any easier or better, that we'll continue to adapt to address the problems we face in a better way. I think we were all very apprehensive about 2024, right? Some people even said that by the end of that year, we would know if democracy will survive or not. And it was not black and white. We saw a bit of everything last year. We saw many great things too. At least 38 elections resulted in a change in government. And this does not mean, of course, that the new rulers will be more democratic, but at least it's a sign that they have not tilted the playing field enough to prevent losses at the polls, right? We also saw some increases in checks and balances in some countries. In India, for example, where now the BJP will have to be more accountable to coalition partners. Africa had a record 5 opposition victories, so also showing how the opposition is strengthened and being able to collaborate and coordinate better. Some countries also have mitigated the impact of disinformation, like Taiwan, especially countering the Chinese attacks. So yeah, we are seeing some good signs as well.
Dr. Fernanda Baril is a deputy director for the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, or IFES. Fernanda, thank you so much for joining us on Democracy Optimist.
Thank you, Josh.
Josh, today's conversation has focused on a global perspective to elections. In November, you spent a week in Brazil giving talks about the U.S. election and learning about the Brazilian system. What did you learn?
Yeah, I had such a great experience in Brazil. The people there are amazingly generous and kind. Brazil and the U.S. have a lot of similarities. Their former president, Jair Bolsonaro, is often compared to President Trump in the way they approach democracy. We had January 6, 2021. They had a similar episode, January 8, 2023, when, after Bolsonaro lost re-election, a mob of his supporters attacked Brazil's federal government buildings in the capital, Brasilia. Bolsonaro claimed, without any evidence, that the election was mired in fraud. One big difference, however, is that Brazil's election court ruled that Bolsonaro cannot run for office again until at least 2030 as a punishment for using government resources to undermine Brazil's voting system. The U.S. Supreme Court, by contrast, found that Trump was immune from prosecution for any acts that were deemed official, and he went on to win the 2024 presidential election. In fact, many people I spoke with in Brazil said that barring Bolsonaro from running again in 2026 was vital to sustaining Brazilian democracy. But of course, we'll see as the years go on how much that continues, because Bolsonaro still is an important figure in Brazil's politics.
We also learned a lot about Brazil's voting system. It's quite different from what we have here in the U.S. What did you find out?
Here's one of the most fascinating things I learned in Brazil. Voters cast their ballots on an electronic machine that does not actually list the candidates for office. Instead, each candidate is given a number, and the voters must input the number on the voting machine for the candidate they prefer. The reason? Logistics. Brazil has a proportional system, where the parties receive seats in the legislature in proportion to the vote totals, and each party can put up the same number of candidates as there are seats available in each region. So in Sao Paulo, for example, there are 70 seats available, and there are multiple political parties. It would be impossible to list all of the candidates for every party. Instead, each polling place has a master list with the candidates and their designated numbers that voters can look at before voting. Voters can't bring in their cell phones with them to vote. They must leave them on a table at the polling place before going to the machine. So they have to memorize the number of the candidate that they prefer or write it down on a piece of paper to bring with them. But no one seemed to think this was strange. They all accepted it as a normal and routine process of voting. Brazil also has mandatory voting, though it's easy to provide an excuse for not voting. And they have virtually no absentee balloting. Again, few people there think any of this is odd or needs changing. It just goes to show that there are lots of ways to run an election system that can achieve democratic legitimacy.
What's one thing that we can do to support democracy?
I think it's important for people in the U.S. to consider election policies from other countries. Maybe they don't make sense for the U.S., but maybe they do. Take mandatory voting, for example. I'm often dismayed when we see voter turnout of around 2/3 of the electorate in the U.S., and yet people celebrate what they think is strong voter engagement. What about that other 1/3 that didn't vote? Last year on this show, we spoke with E.J. Dion about universal voting in the U.S. What can other countries teach us about this issue? So, to support democracy, especially in an off year in the U.S., I encourage listeners to think about an international perspective to election rules. IFES has a great resource on elections around the world, which you can find at electionguide.org.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU.
Educate myself on the fight.